This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In a hospital, code red means a fire where the alarm signals and everyone's evacuated. For Australian blogger David Spratt, planet Earth is in a code red situation. We can't evacuate anywhere else, so we need a fast response to put out the developing fires of climate change. I've been checking David's work at climatecodered.org for a few years now. His emphasis on science and links to his sources has brought him a reputation as a leading voice for climate action. Where he seemed almost on the fringe with what he was recommending a few years ago, new science has proved him right too many times. Now Spratt says all the talk of a safe climate with a budget of carbon left to burn is a very dangerous illusion, and I've called him to ask him why. David Spratt, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
What was this illusion of a safe level of 2 degrees warming so often used by government reports and international climate meetings? Maybe we'll debunk that, but first let's get, what was the thinking behind that 2 degree target?
This is very ironic, but it goes back to 1975, or the first recorded use of this target, by all things, not a climate scientist, but an economist called William Nordhaus. In a presentation to the Cowles Foundation, and he said, look, let's look back over the last million years, and we seem to have had climates that are up to 2 degrees warmer than they are now, and they don't seem to have been too bad. So I think up to 2 degrees warmer than now would be okay. And that's where it started. And the problem is that that was a political statement, not a scientific one. The scientists always see it as a political target, and the politicians see it as a scientific target. And I think Nordhaus was wrong in his understanding of paleoclimate the last million years. There have been very few circumstances where we got to 2 degrees warmer than now, and for no sustained period. And as well, until 10,000 years ago, we didn't have human civilization. We wandered the planet. We ran away from ice sheets. We were not sedentary. The sea levels went up and down. We could shift. We no longer have those options. So it was a very optimistic target.
So if it's not safe, who is saying that it's dangerous, and why would anybody say that?
Well, I mean, it's just become embedded in the political process, the international process, as the target that we should go by. It was embedded a long time ago when it seemed a long way away and we wouldn't have to do too much too quickly. And now it's upon us. And it's sort of, it's become the climate policy paradigm. And I guess we'll talk about that more. But now there are two things which are really obvious. Most people involved in the political policy making no longer think it's attainable, and the science is increasingly telling us that it's too high.
Right. I mean, look, we're already seeing the Arctic sea ice melting, and we've just had recent reports that Antarctica, the glaciers there, are melting.
Yes, those Antarctic reports, I think, are really significant. I heard a climate scientist here in Australia talk about it last night, where we have two reports saying at the current level of warming, the oceans under those ice sheets where they extend into the ocean is now so warm that they're eating into those glaciers. Once they get past the rock that they're grounded on, those glaciers actually are below sea level. So water will flood in, and the leading researcher, Eric Rignow, has said they're now in unstoppable meltdown. And I think the climate community believes that's very sound research. 1 to 3 metres of sea level rise from those two glaciers, probably triggering the rest of the West Antarctic. So we're talking about 5 metres of sea level rise there, triggered by the current temperature of less than 1 degree. So that's just one really good example of tipping points which perhaps 20, 30 years ago the science suggested may not happen to the 2 to 3 degree range, now happening under 2. 10 years ago, they thought Greenland would melt around 3 degrees. More recent science says 1.5 degrees plus or minus a bit. So the science is becoming more severe, and the safe zone is really being drawn down a lot from 2 degrees to it's 1 to 1 degree now.
So where do you live?
I live in Melbourne, Australia.
Right, okay. Because I'm thinking Sydney will go under.
Well, Australia is a very urbanized country. 80% of our population live within 50 kilometres of the coast. So we have a population which is very vulnerable to sea level rise.
Now, you have written about what happens if we don't make it. What does a 3 degree world look like?
This is a question because we as humans have no human memory of this because the last time it was 3 degrees warmer was perhaps 3 million years ago in a period called the Pliocene. We do have some records from that. There's actually a very wonderful book called 6 Degrees that some of your listeners may have read, published 5 or 6 years ago by Mark Linus, where he talks about what the impacts would be at each degree of warming. But we know, for example, that during the last ice age, it was about 5 degrees cooler and sea levels were 120 metres lower. We also know that the last time there's no ice on the planet, sea levels were 70 metres higher, it was 4 degrees warmer. And if you put those two figures together, you have to understand that in the long run, each 1 degree of change produces about 15 metres of sea level rise. So with 3 degrees warmer, we are talking about sea level rises in the tens of metres. We're talking about the northern hemisphere having no ice. In the Pliocene, there were beech trees growing in the transantarctic mountains in the southern hemisphere. Certainly at 3 degrees, the Amazon would cease to be a rainforest because there would be less rainfall and drying and more heat there. Forest fires, which are now once every 20 years, they think would be most years, and most of the Amazon would burn and come back as a dry forest, and that would release billions of tons of carbon into the air. So we're talking about a remaking, both in terms of sea levels and vegetation of the Earth's surface.
You know, David, I remember listening to a recording of a speech by John Schellenhuber, and it was at the 4 Degrees or More conference in Sydney, Australia, back in 2011. And Schellenhuber, he's one of the world's top scientists. At the time, he was a climate advisor to German Chancellor Angela Merkel. He said, there are a series of processes known to physics which suggest that the climate may not stabilize anywhere near 4 degrees warming. It may sort of bump up to 7 or 8 degrees above pre-industrial levels. It's hard to imagine. It was a chilling speech. Can civilization survive that kind of warming?
I had the privilege of actually hearing two speeches he made at that time, and he's a wonderfully direct scientist in the way he communicates. What he's saying is that on the present business-as-usual trajectory for emissions, we're heading towards 3.5 or 4 degrees of warming this century. But that doesn't include what are called long-term climate feedback, something that Jim Hansen from NASA talked about a lot. So things like destabilizing of the Arctic carbon stores, the ocean not taking down carbon dioxide as efficiently, the soils and the plants, for example, the Amazon not storing as much carbon dioxide, starting to see permafrost or methane clash rate coming out of the Arctic. So our normal emissions will get us 4 degrees, but if these feedbacks kick in, and they certainly will in the 2 to 3 degree range, we could see much more. And Sheldon Hoover was one of two scientists, and the other one being Kevin Anderson a few years ago, who said, if we get to 4 degrees of warming, we think our best expert guess is that the carrying capacity of the planet will be under 1 billion people. So that's a very stunning statement. Other people, James Lovelock said that many years ago, and more recently the presentation in England, Kevin Anderson said, I think 4 degrees is incompatible with the continuation of human civilization. So I think there's a widespread view that it's simply, we could not go on as we are, and obviously at 4 degrees of sea levels, when the end get up to 70 metres, that's going to drown most of human civilization. So it's a very dramatic scenario.
Now, coupled with this idea of a safe 2 degrees was the whole idea of a carbon budget, that we could still burn a certain amount of fossil fuels for a decade or two and be all right. What is this idea of the carbon budget? Where did that come from?
Well, look, that came essentially from a couple of very well-received papers in 2009 by Miles Allen and Malte Meinshausen, who's now a researcher here at the University of Melbourne. And they said there seemed to be a fairly linear relationship between the total amount of carbon put into the atmosphere and the temperature rise, which they documented. And then they said, if you want 2 degrees of warming, how much total carbon could you put in the atmosphere? And the answer is not one number, it's many numbers, because it depends on the risk you want to take of exceeding 2 degrees, because there's obviously quite a bit of uncertainty in the climate system about whether the terrestrial and ocean carbon sinks will maintain their efficiency or become less or more. There's the question of these long-term feedbacks, which is called climate sensitivity. In the end, if you double the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, in the short run you get 3 degrees of warming, but perhaps in the long run you get 6 degrees of warming. So these carbon budgets are associated with the probability of not exceeding a target. So, for example, in the IPCC report last year, and I have to say that so far humans have put 550, this is the first number, about 550 billion tonnes of carbon in the air. And they said, look, if you want a 33% chance of staying below 2 degrees, then you can have 1,500 budget. If you want a 50% chance, it comes down to 1,200. If you want a 66% chance of staying under 2 degrees, then it's 1,000. And then if we take gases other than carbon dioxide, because we're putting up methane and nitrous oxide and so on, then perhaps the budget is 800. So by different probabilities or risk, we've gone from 1,500 to 800. And remember, we've already put up 550. So the basic position was, if you want a 2 in 3 chance of not exceeding 2 degrees, the budget is 800, and we've already put up 550. So there's about 250 billion tonnes left, and we're putting up more than 10 billion tonnes a year at the moment. So that means, at the present rate, the budget would run out in 20-odd years. So that was what the IPCC said.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with Australian David Spratt, proprietor of the popular Climate Code Red blog. Well, that sounds okay, David. We've still got another 10 or 20 years to go on driving our cars and flying our planes. So what's the problem?
Look, I think there are three problems with this. The first is that this budget of having 250 billion tonnes left has a 1 in 3 chance of actually going above 2 degrees. And we know at 2 degrees that the West Antarctic ice sheet is gone. Certainly our coral reef systems will go at 1.5 degrees. That Greenland will probably go, that there'll be sea level rises in the tens of metres. So we don't want to go above the target. People who work in risk management, for example, in building planes and buildings and so on, saying their risk or probability of failure is 1 in 1,000,000. You wouldn't get in a plane if there was 1 in 3 chance of it crashing. It is literally 1 in 1,000,000 or 1 in 10,000,000. But we're having a target with a probability of failure of 1 in 3. And given the consequences over 2 degrees, that's obviously unacceptable. And if you look further at these carbon budgets and actually give the figures, if you said we don't want the chance of going above 2 degrees to be more than 10%, then suddenly we have no carbon budget left.
And have we allowed in these budgets the carbon that we're going to have to burn just to produce enough food for the billions of people on the planet?
We've got this carbon budget left, but we have to remember that we're going to have ongoing emissions from particularly food production, that's methane and nitrous oxide, and also from deforestation for the rest of this century. And they did a piece of work published by the Proceedings of the Royal Society in 2008, and they said, let's make really optimistic assumptions about food and deforestation emissions for the rest of the century. Let's assume that the emissions per unit of output halve, that is, that the food we eat will only have half the emissions that it does now. And they ran their models, they had 18 different scenarios, and once you add in those food and deforestation emissions, 10 of the 18 scenarios, and this was 6 years ago, had no budget left for 2 degrees. So once you take in food and deforestation, whatever remaining budget is left is used up. And so for fossil fuels, we literally, even at this 1 in 3 chance of exceeding 2 degrees, we have no budget left. That's the brutal reality.
Well, you know we're going to want to eat. So if there's no more carbon we can safely burn other than that, what does that mean for society? I mean, we think we can't stop using fossil fuels today, this year, or even in the coming decade. So what are we talking about?
Indeed. Well, look, I think that we've been involved in thinking about climate change. I mean, there's a paradigm, there's a frame around which this is constructed, which is said internationally. Let's go for 2 degrees. We think that will be okay. Now, that's not okay. And we think we can achieve this by actions which will absolutely not be disruptive to the economy or the workings of society. I mean, both Sir Nicholas Stern in England and Professor Garnaut in Australia, who did a Stern-like report for Australia, actually in the report said, look, initially, we should go for 2 degrees, but we think this might be a bit disruptive for the economy, so let's go for 3 degrees instead. This was Stern's initial report. So you can see when it comes to, is it the climate is important or is it not rocking the economic boat? The economy and the maintenance of things as they are has taken absolute priority, and that's why we've got into the jam that we have now. And the simple conclusion is that that paradigm no longer works. It's expired. It's run out of time. We wish it hadn't. We had reduced emissions under this paradigm, but we haven't. And now we have to say, as Ban Ki-moon has said, as Al Gore says, we actually now face an emergency. And what do we understand by emergency? It means dropping what we normally do in order to solve an overwhelming problem. We have incredible bushfires here in Australia, which your listeners may have seen last Australian spring, and they think it's actually going to destroy parts of Australia where people can live. And in a bushfire, you don't go about your normal business. You drop everything you do the same with floods, with storms, with cyclones, and you get to work at speed to solve the problem, and I think that's what we've reached now.
Okay, now, just before we get to your proposal of a sort of climate war strategy, I want to mention that Utah scientist Dr. Timothy Garrett calculated in a peer-reviewed paper that only a complete collapse of industrial civilization could prevent a climate catastrophe. Are you calling for a collapse?
Is economic collapse necessary to save ourselves?
Yes.
Well, if we don't act, then that will de facto become the case. There's a former leader of Greenpeace, an Australian called Paul Gilding, wrote a great book 3 years ago called The Great Disruption, which he said for all sorts of reasons, the Club of Rome reasons about limits to growth and running out of resources, he said if we don't act and change the way we're behaving, and he spent a long time in the corporate world, he said we will get a collapse, we will get a great disruption, and what we need to do is start to act differently now in order to avoid it. So I don't think it's inevitable, but it's certainly by lack of action where we're heading at the moment.
Now back in December 2012, you wrote about scientists who backed a war-type footing to address this essential threat. And what are you calling for? Is it a war strategy?
Well, look, I mean, I guess there's a whole lot of analogies we can use. I think what we have to accept is that the paradigm of slow growth, of incremental change, which says we can do this by, you know, a few carbon taxes, a deal here, a deal there. We don't want to upset people. We don't want to affect their standard of living. We don't want anything that's too disruptive to the economy. We can stick within the free market. What we in Australia, perhaps in Canada, would call the neoconservative or neoliberal agenda, can do this. Now, that obviously can't work. We have to reduce emissions really fast now. We've run out of time. And that is essentially going to mean us putting aside a lot of things we normally care about and are our social priorities in order to solve this problem. It means radically reducing our demand for energy, because that's the quickest way to get emissions done. It means changing our whole energy supply system in as fast a period of time as we can. It's going to take a few years to scale up. Some people call it the war economy. Some people call it emergency mode. It doesn't matter the words. It's that sense, and I guess some people look to Britain in 1939-40 when Churchill took over, and in the mid-30s when he was saying, the rise of Germany is a problem, we have to rearm. And they thought he was a nutter, he was a crazy. The government in power said, no, we'll sign a peace deal with Germany, this is all okay. And when Churchill came in, he really did turn things around. In the United States in 1940, defence spending was something like 2% of their economy. In 3 years' time, it was 30%. Now, I don't want all our money to be spent on military equipment, but it's the sort of rapid change, rapid scale out that we actually physically need now that makes us use those form of words.
Right. The American government said to the auto industry, you're not going to produce another car. And it was a very important part of the economy at that time. You're going to switch over to building parts for tanks and boats and planes.
Absolutely. And we would say to industry, now you're going to stop building this and you're going to start building large-scale solar farms or wind towers, or you're going to start producing electric long-haul train systems and transport systems. I mean, we have incredible industrial capacity. We have incredible financial capacity. I mean, it would be sad if the global financials, the global decision-making could save the banks in 2008 but couldn't save the planet. So it's not capacity, it's social and political will, and people will desperately stick to the existing paradigm until it's clear that it can't work, and then I think they will switch. So the work I've done on the end of the carbon budget is just one attempt to demonstrate that this larger, faster scale of action is now necessary. It's the only option because the other option has run out of time.
And how seriously do you take this threat of Arctic methane? We've been talking about a carbon budget and what humans produce, but this is something else, isn't it?
Yes, well, there are two forms of problems in the Arctic. One is what we would known as terrestrial or ground permafrost, which is frozen ground in which is laid down very rich carbon stores, which are frozen and therefore immobile at the moment on land. And as it gets warmer, they will melt and emissions will come up either as methane if it's anaerobic through water or as carbon dioxide. The bigger problem with it is what is called, I shouldn't say bigger, the permafrost has more carbon in it than is in the atmosphere now, so it's a very large problem. But a more striking problem in a way are what are called methane clathrates, which is huge amounts of methane in a frozen form on the bottom of the ocean on the surface layer underneath. It's thought that one of the great extinctions 65, 75 million years ago was produced by a catastrophic release of clathrates, and this is now a very hot topic. We don't have the history to know exactly the conditions but when it might happen, but Professor Peter Wadhams from Cambridge, who's one of the leading Arctic experts, says, you know, I think it could happen within a couple of degrees, and has given a very compelling argument. He put out a paper in Nature, which was very controversial, saying 50 billion tonnes of this could come up. Given the amount of warming in the Arctic, given that we've lost three quarters of sea ice by volume in summer in 20 or 30 years, which must, when there's none of that ice reflecting the sun and the Arctic in summer is a dark, brooding rock and ice mass, Greenland will go. The degree of warming in the Arctic at the moment is 2 to 3 times the global average. It could kick up to 4 times the global average. If it gets hot enough, will those clathrates go? Absolutely. Do we know when? Not yet.
You know, David Spratt, I do get some listener emails who say we shouldn't really always focus on the alarmism, and I do try and put out some solutions, but you've published a little booklet explaining why looking for the bright side in climate change is a mistake. Why do you say that?
Look, we had an experience in Australia where we had a Labor government, I guess what you'd maybe call a less than standard government, try to bring in a carbon tax, a price on pollution. In 2010, and the Conservative opposition, what you have in Canada, really mauled them about it and said that they withdraw it. And the government actually got very frightened about talking about climate change because they hadn't done the work, and end up trying to sell this carbon tax by talking about clean energy all the time and never talking about climate change, which I thought was a very bad mistake. And I talked to people in marketing and advertising, and they said, yes, you can't sell an answer unless you explain the problem. They said, if you want to explain and build up support for climate action, they said, your narrative must be science, 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 solution. That is, you explain the problem and then you tell people what the answer is. And we have some very clear data in Australia where we have perhaps the world's leading practice on stopping smoking, on health promotion, very effective campaigning, which has taken advertising out and plain paper packaging now, which has driven down smoking rates a lot. And they say there's always three elements. Explain the problem really brutally, really honestly. Show people what the answer is and show them the efficacious path, the action they can take to get from the problem to the answer. So they'll show you what smoking does to your lungs. They can say, you can stop, and here's the steps you can take to stop. And that path is well established in health promotion. And I think in climate change too, we can't get people to accept radical, strong action without explaining why the problem's so severe. And I think the same thing happened with the Obama administration at the same time. Perhaps the Australian government borrowed from the United States and was a disaster there. And now in the United States, through things like Climate Nexus, they've got back on top of the climate debate with the deniers and started talking about connecting the dots, extreme weather and that sort of thing, and support for climate action's gone up. So I agree we need to talk about the answers. It's absolutely true we need a positive story to tell, but if we don't explain a problem to people, we can't expect them to support the answer to that problem.
All right. Now, I'd like to find out just a little bit more about you on behalf of our listeners. When did you start the Code Red blog and why? And why did you stake out what seemed to be an extreme position at the time and now is becoming more mainstream?
Well, look, this is, I have not been in climate all my life. I'm not a climate scientist. I've actually been involved in other community struggles around peace and justice and so on. And I came to the issue 10 or 11 years ago when I thought the Stern Report was a bit too conservative. And then we had our own Stern Report in Australia called Lugano Report. And I started writing a submission with a friend of mine to that report. And as I started to write the submission, there was that incredible melting in the Arctic in 2007, which astounded scientists, where they talked about melting being 100 years ahead of schedule. And the more I studied the science, I came to understand that there was a science story which was different from the one that was in the mainstream media. I mean, it's the story that Jim Hansen was telling about feedbacks and 2 degrees being too high, and him saying we're already on the edge of the precipice beyond which there's no redemption. So I did a lot of serious reading in the science, and we also wrote about emergency mode and solutions. And from reading the science, I just tried to write in a book called Climate Code Red, the Case for Emergency Action with Philip Sutton, what I thought the science really meant. And we had a chapter on the Arctic, which I read last week, which really echoed what that research 2 weeks ago has found out to be true. So we weren't scientists. We could be slightly speculative. But I have to say, most of the things we wrote in that book that people thought we've perhaps gone a bit on the edge on, in the last 6 years, have largely proved to be correct. So the book was not too radical. The book has really, in terms of its science, I think, become much more mainstream, sadly, because it's at the difficult end of impacts happening more quickly and at lower temperatures than were previously expected.
We're just about out of time, but I want to ask, is there a particular theme or idea that is occupying your mind now, something that you're developing?
Well, look, I think the most recent posting I did, which is on this carbon budget, really is the thing I've spent a bit of time on. They can find on the website climatecodered.org. The posting is called The Real Budgetary Emergency and the Myth of Burnable Carbon. And ever since the IPCC report came out, I've been concerned that the understanding of the carbon budget wasn't really there, and there were headlines saying we've got half the budget left to burn, and I could see that we didn't. So I think recent science, this work in the Antarctic, shows us that things are happening much more quickly. So that's one thing. The other thing is this failure of the international process. And you bring those two together, and it's time to say we need a paradigm shift. We have to think differently about how we're going to solve this problem by really devoting much more of our society's resources to it, because that's the inevitable situation we've reached in this clash between politics and science.
It is a Code Red. We've been speaking with Australian climate blogger, author, and activist David Spratt. Find his work at climatecodered.org, and I suggest you check that regularly. You'll find not just voices from Australia, but around the world that mainstream media seldom publish. David, thank you for helping us out this time on Radio EcoShock.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith. Find links to the articles and issues we've just talked about in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. That's published every Wednesday.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.